I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. You don't need me to tell you that inflation is taking a bite out of your income. You no doubt have been feeling the pain of higher prices. What with gas at something like $5 a gallon and the increased cost of food at the supermarket. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell announced yesterday that the bank was raising interest rates by 0.75 percentage point in an attempt to tamp down inflation. It's the sharpest rate hike in almost 30 years since 1994. It's a tricky balancing act for the central bank to reduce inflation without slowing the economy too much and triggering a recession. The bank has been criticized for flooding the economy with cheap money and not responding quickly enough to inflation, which is now at a 40-year high. There are pressures on the U.S. economy from the pandemic, increased demand, supply chain problems, consumer anxiety, the war in Ukraine, among other things, and some bright spots, including the low rate of unemployment. Well, today in Radio Times, what the Fed hike means and where the economy is going. And we have two guests. Dean Baker is senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Dean Baker, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
You're very welcome. And also with us, Allison Schrager. She's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. She's also a columnist at Bloomberg Opinion. Allison Schrager, nice to have you with us as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And let me just make sure our listeners can join us. And you can do that several different ways. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Allison, let me begin with you. Did the Fed do the right thing yesterday?
Yeah, absolutely. I think with inflation still not going down or in fact going up, they really needed to send a signal to markets. They're serious about slowing inflation. And a lot of economists think we should front load the rate hikes. So do more now as opposed to later. So I think it was the right thing to do.
How about for you, Dean Baker?
Well, the Fed gets sort of backed into a corner. You get all this discussion in the media about what the Fed's going to do, the financial press. And there had been this expectation before the meeting, ever since the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, came out last Friday for May, and was higher than just about all of us expected. Yeah. So there was this expectation that they would raise interest rates by 0.75 percentage point. And if they had not done that yesterday, then there would have been serious concern that they're not taking inflation seriously. So given the expectations in markets, I think they made the right call. What I worry about is that they go too far with further rate hikes. But in terms of what they did yesterday, I think it was the right move.
Let me pick up on that, and I'll go back to you, Dean Baker, because apparently Powell is thinking of another rate hike maybe sometime this summer.
Well, I don't expect that this is the end of their hikes. I mean, there's two issues. One is changes, one is levels. So we're still looking at the interest rate we're currently looking at is 1.75%. That's a pretty low interest rate. So by we go back pre-pandemic, we're around 2.5% for the most part there. So getting back to something like that when the unemployment rate's 3.6%, I'd be hard-pressed to argue with that. So if we have subsequent rate hikes, a quarter point, maybe a half point, again, more than one, but sequences, I'd be hard-pressed to argue with that. But if we say do another 0.75% rate hike at the next meeting, I'd be concerned. But obviously, we'll have more data between now and then. So if we continue to see bad story on inflation, then I wouldn't argue with it. But I'm expecting better news.
To you, Allison Schrager, what will this actually mean then for consumers? And I guess if you're going to be borrowing money, you're going to pay more for that money. Is that the sort of most immediate impact of a rate hike such as this?
So, I mean, obviously, it's going to mean higher credit card rates, higher mortgages. If you're looking to borrow money, rates are going to go higher. But I mean, I think it's important to think, this isn't, high inflation is a lot of ways even worse, right? Because things like mortgage rates are often in the long term tend to be focused off the 10-year bond rate. And that is heavily influenced by what we expect inflation to be in the future. So if people start to expect high inflation going forward, that's also going to increase yields. And that is also going to increase what you pay for a mortgage or what you pay for any sort of loan. So, it's not like, there's a false choice here. High inflation really poses even bigger costs than raising rates now.
And Does it impose even bigger costs if you're a low-income person, that you're just going to end up paying more out of your salary or your income to cover basic costs?
Exactly, because if you're lower income, a much bigger share of your budget is in the things that are really taking off, food and energy. And also, you know, if you're a higher income person, you have what economists say more scope to substitute your consumption. So, you know, maybe if costs are a little higher, you know, you don't pick up your groceries at a convenience store, you actually bother to go to the grocery store because you were spending more anyway. But if you're a low-income person, you're probably already pinching every penny. So there's not a lot of scope to sort of find cheaper ways to consume.
Dean, you want to weigh in on that? I mean, the idea, obviously, it's, you know, this is a, it's a big deal what the Federal Reserve did, but the impact is not going to be, I guess, shared equally across consumers.
Yeah, well, I think actually the issue of who suffers worse inflation is a little more complicated. Now, one of the things that's been largely lost in these discussions is the low unemployment rate has actually meant that a lot of workers at the bottom have gotten very high pay increases the last couple of years. So if you look at workers in hotels and restaurants, their pay's gone up 20% over the last 2 years. So that's outpaced inflation. So that's a pretty good story. And it's true that a lot of low-income people, you have, say, energy costs, gas costs, being a disproportionate share of their budget. But for better or worse, a lot of low-income people don't own cars. They can't afford it. So for those people, they might actually not be as hard hit by the run-up in gas prices. Food, of course, will be a larger share of their budget. So I would just say it's a somewhat more mixed picture, that it's not always that clear who's being hardest hit by inflation. And the story of this inflation, of course, it's been very uneven across goods. So gas has soared more than anything. Yeah. Car prices have soared. Lower income people aren't buying cars, particularly new cars. They might be buying used cars, which have risen even more. But I just say it's a little more complex, and we do have to look at the other side of the market, that the labor market, a strong labor market, disproportionately benefits lower income people. And if the cost of raising rates is the push up the unemployment rate by 2 or 3 or 4 percentage points, as it may turn out to be. I'm not saying that it will, but I mean, if you go too far, that's the story we could be looking at. It's going to be lower income people that feel that most.
Well, Allison, I mentioned the kind of tricky balancing act then the Fed has to do, which is trying to control the inflation rate without triggering a recession or hurting people that are the most vulnerable in our society.
Well, yeah, as I said, but again, there's a lot of sort of false choices here. I mean, I think people have posed it as either, you know, we get a grip on inflation, but that might trigger a recession. I think letting inflation keep on going also causes a lot of damage to the economy and even sort of can become recessionary if it really gets out of hand and of itself. So I think the balancing act is trying to figure out, can they increase rates enough just to slow the economy and not, say, cause a recession? Or even if they cause a very mild recession, that's bigger than the much bigger, more damaging recession that would come from letting inflation run wild.
What would that rate be? I mean, is there a kind of Goldilocks number here?
Well, no one knows for sure, but most economists think, okay, so there's like three modes of monetary policy, roughly. There's accommodative, which is where they're pushing the economy to go faster. There's neutral, where they're not really pushing it or tamping down on it. And then there's sort of contractionary, which is where they're tamping down on the economy. Right now, they're still pushing the economy to be faster. They're still pushing demand to be higher because, as Dean pointed out, rates are still very negative in that the federal fund rate is 1.7%, but inflation is 8.6% or 6% if you strip out food and energy. So that's a very negative rate. That's like negative 5%. So right now, all the Fed is doing is trying to get to what we call neutral, where they're just not making inflation worse. So I think the plan is to go to there, which might be like 3%, maybe 3.5%, and then to check in and say, okay, is inflation going down now? Can we stop at neutral?
Dean, let me go back to you. And when you sort of boil it all down, is it a supply and demand problem? Is that what is driving inflation, which is apparently increased demand and obviously all these supply chain problems?
Well, clearly supply and demand. The real problem, though, is how much of the issue is sort of temporary supply side stories as opposed to, well, the economy just can't produce more. And clearly a lot of it is temporary supply side stories. But the question is that the bulk of that, or is that just, you know, the smaller part? And to my view, a very big chunk of this is sort of the classic supply chain stories that we've been talking about for the last year and a half, as We've had the ships sitting off the shore in Los Angeles and other places unable to unload. And as a result of that, a wide range of goods that ordinarily don't show much rise in prices, apparel typically falls in price 1-2% a year. It's risen about 7% over the last year. Appliances, the same story. Cars and trucks, we know there was the fire in a semiconductor factory in Japan, creating worldwide shortage of semiconductors, sent car prices soaring and used car prices rising even more. So those are one-time factors. So the question is, how much of this are sort of one-time factors that we can expect to go away? Others are even more complicated because we know the oil price has soared in large part because of the war in Ukraine. So we go, well, what's going to happen to the war in Ukraine? I don't have an answer to that. But obviously, if you had some sort of, say, ceasefire, I don't think Putin's about to shake hands and say all's good, but if you had some sort of ceasefire and that market stabilized, oil prices would probably come down quite a bit. But the big question, at least to me, is how much of this is sort of one-time supply issues that we might expect, at least in many cases, to go away relatively quickly. And if that's the case, then I very much worry that Powell might be overdoing it. Again, I'm fine with the three quarters,
sure,
but if we go on a path of high hikes going forward, that's going to be a big problem.
Allison, let me ask you about something that the President Biden said yesterday. He didn't exactly accuse oil companies of profiteering, but he did say at a time of war, refinery profit margins well above normal being passed directly onto American families are not acceptable. How would we know if there is profiteering when it comes to the oil industry?
Well, I think it's hard to know. I mean, as I said, like a lot of energy companies were losing money before, and as well faced a lot of regulatory pressure to do less exploring. So I think it's hard to know. And as I said, I think we also really need to decide, you know, if we're really committed to more energy or importing it from abroad. I mean, thinking long term, I think getting energy prices under control is more of sort of a long term issue.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the role of the government, as opposed to getting immediate inflation under control. That's more under the Fed's purview.
And in part because during the pandemic, when so many people were literally not driving to work, there was a glut of oil. Allison.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very volatile industry where prices are volatile and so are profits. So as I said, sometimes you have high profits and other times that makes up for times you have lower profits or even negative profits. So I think it's hard to sort of accuse them of profiteering sort of in one snapshot of the economy.
Dean, we're almost up on a break. Anything you want to just weigh in very quickly?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, getting back to a point Allison rightly raised, that we're worried about this getting out of hand. And one of the things I look to is wage growth. And that's actually slowed sharply, which I'm not happy to say because I like to see workers getting higher pay. Right. But in terms of a wage price spiral, if wages are slowing, we don't really have to worry about that.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Dean Baker, senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Allison Schrager is with us as well. She's a senior fellow with the Manhattan Institute. She's also a columnist at Bloomberg Opinion. We're talking about the fact that yesterday the Fed announced that it was raising interest rates by 0.75 percentage point. Talking about what that means and speaking largely about the issue of inflation, some worries about a recession, kind of what's happening, what's up with our economy. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Allison Schrager and Dean Baker about what the Federal Reserve Bank did yesterday, and also a general discussion about the state of the economy, the issue of inflation, of course, which everyone is feeling. Dean, let me go back to you. And as we know, during the pandemic, the federal government spent trillions of dollars, some of it directly to American families, stimulus checks, a child tax credit, unemployment checks. We actually reduced child poverty, you know, during the pandemic, which I thought that was a terrific thing to be able to do. Obviously, that those days are over. But nonetheless, did the federal government feed the rate of inflation?
Well, I think it clearly had some effect in boosting inflation. So, as you said, I mean, I think in a lot of ways, and this is bipartisan to some extent, because some of the CARES Acts were when Donald Trump was in the White House.
Right.
So it's bipartisan that the government did a very good job protecting people from the worst effects, at least economically, the worst effects of a horrible pandemic, and that was a great accomplishment. As you say, child poverty went down, and then we managed to boost the labor market. We got the unemployment rate down pretty much to the lowest level it's been in 50 years. And one of the points, because people get confused on this, they go, oh, that's good. You get a few hundred thousand more people working. Mm-hmm. It's not just that. When you get a low unemployment rate, that means people have power in the labor market. So if you feel you're at a bad job, it's a dead end, your boss is a jerk, you can quit and get another job. And we have about 6 million people, over 6 million people that lose or leave their job every single month. So a low unemployment rate's a really big deal, particularly for those at the bottom, because it tends not to be doctors and lawyers that are unemployed. These are people working in restaurants, people working in hotels, people generally what we think of as, you know, lower paying, less skilled jobs. Those are the ones that matters to. So that's a really, really big deal. Now, did that boost inflation? I'm inclined to think so, but not by that much, for the simple reason that we could look to Europe, we could look to England, we could look to the European Union. They have comparable inflation rates to the U.S., and they didn't have stimulus packages that were anywhere near as large. And the story there, they feel the same supply chain issues we do. They're seeing gas prices go up, oil prices go up, food prices go up. So a very large part of this are factors that had nothing to do with the stimulus. So I'm sure inflation would be somewhat less if, say, we hadn't had as big a stimulus, but we'd still be talking about it today.
Interesting. How do you see that, Allison?
I disagree. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of factors into inflation, like supply chain shortages coming out, turning off the economy, then turning it on. But I think a lot of the rescue plans were worth it, were useful. I mean, certainly during the pandemic, the first two were very useful. But the one in the spring of 2001, I think most economists agree, was way too large. It was three times the size of lost GDP. And, you know, anyway, Europe also has been having high inflation. Up until war in Ukraine, which sent gas prices higher, their inflation rate was 3 percentage points lower than ours. I mean, that's a lot. So, and right now, economist Jason Furman speculates that their inflation is much more driven by oil prices than ours, which means that it is more transitory and, you know, requires less monetary policy intervention, as opposed to ours came from a more government stimulus, which sort of drives up wages and tightens the labor market, but that also can mean higher inflation, which on balance can make workers worse off.
Let me quote something that Marty Walsh said in the Washington Post. I'll toss this first to you, Allison Schrager. He said, over the past year and a half, Americans have gotten back to work in record numbers faster than during any previous recovery in modern history. For example, the share of people between ages 25 and 54 who are employed has recovered faster since April 2020 than it did during the four previous recoveries. So again, talking about this balancing act, can that also be an example of how some of this spending did benefit people because they are now employed?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's black and white. I'm not arguing, wow, we shouldn't have done any spending at
sure,
all. We just did way too much. I mean, maybe we could have done less and gotten a lot of the same benefits without all of the inflation.
Do you see it that way at all, Dean? Was it too much spending, too quick, too generous?
I see it a little bit. You know, I'm not hugely differing with Allison. I know Jason Furman. I was on a panel with him a little while back, and we were going back and forth, and I said, well, the package probably had 2 percentage points to the inflation rate. And Jason goes, well, it's pretty much right in the middle of my range. I'd put 1 to 4.
Hmm.
So, yes, it definitely added some. But, you know, would we be happy here if the inflation rate were 6.6%? Probably still be concerned about it. But, you know, in terms of the optimal package, and again, I'm thinking back to 2009, President Obama was in the White House, and many of us were saying, you need more stimulus. And I had arguments, as did many people with people's administration. They'd say, well, that may be true, but the politics, blah, 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 this is the best we could do. I think you had a little bit of the reverse situation that, yeah, you know, I wouldn't have given the $2,000 checks, or I guess the stimulus part was the $1,400, we'd just given the $1,600 to people earning over, you know, $80,000 a year. Well, couples earning over $80,000 a year. I would have had much lower cutoffs, in other
words.
There are a lot of people that got those checks that didn't need them. There was more money given to state and local governments than was needed. They overestimated the financial difficulties they were facing. I did too. A lot of us did. So in retrospect, they gave them more money, and many of them have now given tax cuts to their citizens, residents, that boosted demand. So I agree, it was larger than need be. I don't think it was a disaster. It's the sort of thing, if we could sit down in a room and all of us throw out all the political considerations, say, okay, what was the optimal package? I'd be among those saying should have been smaller. but that's not the way the world works.
We got a lot of comments here. I do want to get to them. But Allison, this was something I was just thinking about personally, is that when there is, a high rate of inflation, at least for me personally, I think for other people as well, you kind of lose sight of what something is supposed to cost. I was thinking, what does a hairbrush cost? Is it $4? Is it $9? Is it $18? I have no idea. And I wonder how, when there is inflation like this at a 40-year high, whether the public consumers just sort of don't know what is the correct price for this thing that I'm buying.
Yeah, and that's a really important point because this is one of the ways that inflation is damaging that often people forget. It's not just that you are poorer because your income buys less, but every transaction you have also now has more uncertainty. And certainly in finance, any sort of stream of income that's less certain is considered worth less. So in some ways, your income is taking two hits. It can buy less, but you also have less certainty about what you can buy, which is another reason why it's so damaging. And also that uncertainty poses costs to the economy, is that people sort of hang back. Either they consume too much early because they're worried about prices going up, or they put off making bigger purchases. And so, this also can cause a lot of damage to the economy, sure, which is why inflation of itself can be recessionary.
What do you think, Dean?
I think it can be a problem. I mean, this is more a story when you get to double-digit inflation, 20, 30, 40% inflation that unfortunately many, particularly developing countries, have seen, and we did sort of start to see in the 70s. Yeah. I don't think we were there yet. And again, I'm fairly confident we're going the other way, that we're seeing a lot of items where prices had risen sharply, either level off or even come down. I saw in the data for May, very bad inflation report, but one good item, appliances, fell in price 0.7%. So I point that out because that was the supply chain story. That was an indication that this was an area where appliance prices had soared because people couldn't get them. Now appliances, you're seeing Target, other retailers, we have too much of this stuff. We have to mark down prices. So I think that was coming to an end. But absolutely, if we'd gotten to a point where everything's going up in price 15, 20, 25% a year, yeah, that does create real problems for people trying to make plans, deciding what they should buy, what's a bad price. You don't want that situation.
And that's Dean Baker, who joins us along with Allison Schrager. Let me read a couple of comments. And Allison, I'll put this to you. Dwight asks, if Biden got rid of the Trump-era tariffs, would that have had any impact on inflation and the economy?
It would have at this point, it wouldn't have a huge impact, but overall, it would have a very positive impact. So, I mean, I think when I think about inflation, I think about what's structural, right? Like inflation went down over many years for a lot of things that just structurally changed in the economy. You know, the dollar became more desirable. We had technology that, that brought prices down. So, when I think of sort of an increased trade was a big reason why prices went down over the years, because we were trading a lot with cheap labor countries. So encouraging more trade adds more to the structural sort of level of inflation, which is lower. And I think there's reasons to be concerned. There might be structural things that are pushing inflation higher now. So that would definitely counteract that. So that would make our long-term equilibrium level of inflation, and that would keep that low. So it would be a good reason to do for that more than it would be immediately having an effect.
Dean, how do you see tariffs?
Well, I think in general, they do raise prices, and I mean, that's what they're intended to do. And I think there were a lot of tariffs that were imposed in a very haphazard way under President Trump, and reducing them or in some cases eliminating them, I think that'd be a good thing. The Biden administration already has rolled back a number of them. We had tariffs, I think, on Canadian steel. I mean, there are a number that were kind of, I'm saying that was strange because it was done as national defense and sort of think, well, if we have to worry about Canada, national defense, we're in trouble. But anyhow, I think in general, rolling them back is a good thing to do. They've done some and I hope they do more.
Here's a comment from Stu, and I'll toss this back to you, Dean. He says record high corporate profits fed by blatant price gouging is the reason for high prices. Do you want to respond to Stu's comment there?
Well, we have seen a big jump in corporate profits, so that's really not disputable. If you look at the data for 2021, there was a big shift from wages to profits from where we were before the pandemic. So they clearly have benefited from that. Now, the extent to which that's price gouging, I mean, this is a tough question. So how much are we seeing higher prices, higher profits, because there's more concentration today than, say, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago? I'm not convinced that that's a big factor. I'm not going to say that's no factor, but I think it's just basically the story, oil probably being the best, most obvious example. There's a shortage of oil. that's going to push the price up. That's how you deal with the shortage. And who's sitting there to benefit from that? The companies. So companies try to make money. That's not really disputable. They won't dispute that. And they're in a situation where they stand to make a lot of money when a lot of what they're selling is in short supply. So I don't see anything particularly conspiratorial. I mean, you know, that's capitalism, I guess I'd say.
Well, Allison, how do you see this, the gyrations, I guess, on the stock market in the last, let's say, 4 or 5 months? What is the market responding to?
Well, I mean, it's responding, one, largely to the uncertainty, but primarily it's just responding to the Fed increasing interest rates. So the higher interest rates are, so stocks reflect a sort of projections of future profits discounted at the interest rate. So the higher interest rates are, the lower projected profits are, or discounted profits are. So that just means stock values just immediately go lower. So it's reflecting the uncertainty, and just that sort of higher rates mean lower stock prices.
But do you think the Fed was, you know, plowed too much money into Wall Street?
During the pandemic or now?
Well, or over the last couple of years. I mean, the fact that it seems like the money has been so cheap, and that has benefited so many people on the stock market. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, there's evidence that, you know, some people took their stimulus tests and played the market, although I don't think that was actually that big a factor. But I mean, I don't know if that was just the Fed or just, as I said, just the way the economy was going. A lot of exuberance, particularly in front of tech stocks, that sort of bid up those prices. So I don't know if we can totally blame the Fed, other than, as I said, when they keep rates, if you argue that rates were artificially low going in, then that sort of increases the appetite to hold riskier assets, so you get a higher return. But I don't think we can entirely blame the Fed for that. I think that was just the gyrations of the market, and now we're experiencing a bit of a correction.
And that, again, is Allison Schrager from the Manhattan Institute, also a columnist at Bloomberg Opinion, joining us along with Dean Baker, a senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Dean, I've heard people say, well, the stock market isn't the real economy, but I also read in preparation for the show that something like 34% or a third of households own individual stocks. How should we read what the stock market is doing?
Well, I'd largely agree with the points Allison made, but I'd add one more thing to it, that stock markets in principle are responding to expectations of future profits, and profits did rise a lot in 2020 to 2021. Now, it seems profits are turning. Again, we have data from the first quarter, which showed a fall in profits, first quarter 2021, which 22 showed a fall in profits. I don't make too much of one quarter, but you have a lot of companies, particularly the big retailers, Amazon, Walmart, Target, saying that they're looking to lower profits because they have less pricing power. So in a context where profits are falling, then it's not surprising that the market would also fall. Mm-hmm. Again, in addition to the interest rates issues that Allison raised. Now, again, we have roughly 30% who have, in fact, more of money in the stock market, but you're saying individual stocks. The people of money in the stock market obviously are unhappy about stock prices falling, but insofar as the story is a shift back from profits to wages, the rest of the public should be very happy. But I'll take your specific question. It does concern me. And as a general rule, I tell people, not that I like to give personal financial advice, but it's not a good idea for individuals to have any significant amount of money invested in individual stocks. In other words, the idea that you're going to outguess the market, that you're going to pick the next Tesla or whatever, odds are you're not going to. So if you want to play around like you want to play the lottery, okay, do that. But I really hope people don't put their savings, money they're really depending on for their kids' college education or their retirement or something, into an individual stock betting that they found the next Tesla. Because, again, odds are you haven't.
Allison, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with everything you just said. And but I think I also just want to add that as 34% own some individual stock, but roughly 50 to 55% of Americans have some exposure to the stock market, largely through index funds, which is the best way to invest because it gets you some diversification, which is the best thing you can do in a volatile market. And I mean, one thing that worries me is, you know, well, there was a lot of increased interest in the stock market during the pandemic, especially under lower income people. And I think in a lot of ways that was really good because it does expand ownership. It does give all Americans a piece of profit. And I just hope that the market fall doesn't dissuade people from investing in the future.
Well, let me toss this back to you, Dane. I was also reading that 12% of households have cryptocurrency. What do you think about that? me too.
You know, I've gone back and forth with a lot of people, and I, for the life of me, I don't understand what crypto is supposed to do. I don't understand.
We've done several shows on cryptocurrency, and I do not understand it myself. But go ahead.
Yeah, so, you know, obviously you could make a bet, and if you got in Bitcoin or one of the other cryptos at the right time, you'd probably still up a lot. But if you have something that basically has no inherent value, that's what I would say about cryptocurrencies, then you could lose your shirt on it. So again, if you think of it like a lottery ticket, you know, you could, if you have some money, you don't mind risking $100, $1,000, and you want to take a big gamble, I can't tell someone not to do that. Yeah. But if you really think this is the way to make lots of money, well, that's enormously risky. And I just really hope people don't take bets with money they really need.
Allison, cryptocurrency, where do you stand?
You know, I don't understand it either. And I always felt pressured. I felt pressured to make sense of it, and no one could ever explain it to me. And I felt like compelled to do the work. And so I've been rooting for it to fall just so I didn't have to do the work. So hopefully that's what's happening. But again, I totally agree with Dean here. I think the way to think about investing in crypto is the same way you think about going to a casino. Like, you have your investments, which are hopefully in well-diversified stock in bonds or commodities. And then, like, think about money you're investing in crypto as the same thing as said when you go to a casino. It's like entertainment. It's fun, but it's not your, like, investment strategy.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Allison Traeger and Dean Baker. We began by talking about the fact that the Federal Reserve taking steps to tamp down the high rate of inflation. We're talking about what that could mean for consumers, for the overall economy. And do stay with us. Much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. As you probably know by now, the Federal Reserve raised interest rates by 0.75% on Wednesday in an attempt to slow rising inflation rates. We're talking with our guest, Dean Baker, senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and Allison Traeger, senior fellow with the Manhattan Institute, also a columnist at Bloomberg Opinion, about the impact of raising those rates, also talking about the economy writ large. Allison, let me go back to you, and just for our listeners, just to make sure everyone knows, everyone's on the same page, what is the job of the Federal Reserve Bank? What is their mandate, their overall responsibility?
Well, I mean, technically their mandate is, balancing maximum employment with stable, low inflation. There's also sort of a secondary mandate of financial stability, although that's a little bit explicit. But the way I like to think about it is, you know, monetary policy, as I said, it sort of smooths the rough edges of the economy. It can't, like, change the real economy, other than the fact it provides more certainty. But what it can do, as I said, it should sort of be there to make recessions less bad and sort of to keep big booms from growing out of control to the point where they blow up.
And do you see it that way, Dean?
Yeah, I mean, it has enormous responsibility in this area because obviously it's not the whole economy, since they can't just do things out of thin air. People, right. I forget who came up with the line, the Fed doesn't print oil, so we'd love to see lower oil prices if they don't print oil. But they, on the one hand, have to keep inflation from getting out of control, and then the flip side, that when we get a downturn, to try to boost the economy out of it, which, of course, they did in 2020 and also in 2009, 2010. They tried to do that. I mean, again, they can't single-handedly cause the economy to recover from a severe downturn.
Does the president, any president, have any levers, any control over the inflation rate?
Well, the president can try to get Congress to act with fiscal policy, which, of course, you know, we did have Recovery Act, which Biden had proposed and Congress approved. Other than that, it has some levers. We were talking about tariffs a moment ago, so the president can unilaterally raise lower tariffs, so that's something that has some effect. They have various regulatory measures. One of the things that President Biden did to lower gas prices is release oil from the strategic reserves. Also, you have antitrust policy, which tends to be a more longer-term story. But sometimes you could accomplish if you have someone you think you have a very good antitrust case with. So it's not you're not just yelling at them, we don't like what you're doing. But let's say we had a clear case where we saw the oil companies were colluding, not saying they are, but let's say we had the goods on them. So you say, okay, we're going to go after you with a big antitrust suit. Odds are you would change their behavior quickly. So there are some things like that, but really they tend to be secondary. Fiscal policy, if you actually get Congress to pass a bill spending money or raising taxes, lowering taxes, whatever it might be, that has a big impact. But what the president by themselves can do is much more limited.
Allison, when do you think we'll begin to feel the effects of raising this interest rate?
Well, I mean, I think we're already feeling it. We're feeling it with the lower stock market. We're feeling it with rising mortgage rates. But what its impact on inflation? You know, I'm optimistic that maybe, you know, within the next couple months, because the main primary channel which the Fed maybe has impact on inflation is through expectations. And I think they're sending signals. They're very serious about lowering it. And so hopefully that will lower expectations, which will mean that gets baked into prices. Although pessimistically, that might get sort of crowded out by sort of things like oil price shocks or continued supply chain shortages, certainly from China's zero COVID policy. But assuming those other things don't happen, I think we should hopefully see inflation start to moderate soon.
Let me read a couple more comments. An email from Pat who says, I'm old enough to remember the 1970s when observers talk about inflation coming down. In my memory, it doesn't mean prices come down. Meantime, my wages aren't going up, and I'm talking about an employer dealing with sums in the billions of dollars. Many of us are watching the powerful making decisions that are squeezing us harder with each passing month. And Dean, let me toss that back to you. I just, you know, when you look at consumer confidence, there's a lot of anxiety, I think, for multiple reasons, not just the economy, but just the stresses of the world that we're living in, and the kind of feeling that you know, other people are, rich people are doing better, and the rest of us are struggling along.
Well,
it's unfair.
Yeah, we've seen a massive rise in inequality over the last four decades, and to my view, that is a very bad thing. There are a lot of policies that went to that. I mean, some of them might seem fairly complex. So we have longer and stronger patent and copyright monopolies. So we created, last I looked, and it's probably more than this now, 5 Moderna billionaires from the vaccine. Now, the vaccine was wonderful, but much of that research was paid for on the public dime. We didn't need Moderna, in other words. We could have done it without them. We have had policies that have led to upward redistribution, variety of mechanisms. There was a study done not that long ago that asked corporate directors how they see their jobs. Most of them don't even see it as part of their job to limit CEO pay. Wow. So when you see CEO pay go to 20, 30, 40 million, that's because there's no one on the other side. You're sitting there saying, hey, friends, why don't you give me more money? And they're going, sure, you're our buddy. And you know, and it's not just the CEO, because the CFO, all the others at the top end of the spectrum, they also get very high pay. So, yeah, most workers have gotten very little benefit from the productivity gains of the last four decades. So people are right, in my view, to think that's unfair. And it's not something that just happened this year or last year. It's something that's been going on a long time.
Allison, here's an email from Kyle who says, we're cutting back in our household and making sure we eat all the leftovers. So, you know, there's real suffering that's happening in our economy.
Yeah, and I think that just shows, you know, how important policy is. In some ways, you know, we had the best of intentions, I think, during the pandemic, just that, you know, no amount of money would be too much. Because, you know, people were suffering for a lot of reasons, just not economically, but also the pandemic. And so I think the problem is we're seeing is that, you know, there can be a high cost to those good intentions. And that, you know, if you cause a lot of inflation with them, in the end, people could be even worse off.
Here's a listener tweet who says, how is raising interest rates going to reduce the price of food and car prices that are high because of lack of inventory and oil prices? Allison, can I toss that back to you? And then Dean will hear from you.
Well, I mean, I think the hope is that higher rates will lower demand. And that will, as I said, that lowers prices because less people are demanding goods. But I mean, to some extent, this is one of the big reasons why the Fed, anyway, they get a lot of flack for it, targets what we call core inflation, which is inflation without food and energy, because they don't have a direct impact on that. So, I mean, it has a secondary impact kind of by lowering demand, but And that will, in fact, affect other areas of inflation. And the hope is that helps things overall. But there isn't a lot they can do about food and oil.
What do you think, Dean?
Yeah, I'd very much agree with that. I mean, again, this is one of the reasons why I get concerned when people go, oh, gas prices are rising, the Fed has to raise rates. Well, the Fed's raising rates is not going to bring down gas prices. There are other factors that we could hope for will. Again, the situation in Ukraine, if that stabilizes, that would be a big factor. There's other reasons why we might think oil prices might come down, but the Fed's actions won't do that. One place where, Allison already mentioned this, where it's already had a huge effect is in the housing market. So house prices went up nationally 30% over the last 2 years, and that just is clearly unsustainable. Now, I don't think we're in a bubble. I was one of the people yelling about a bubble back in 2005, 6, and 7. No one paid attention. But anyhow, I don't think we're yet in a bubble, but if you keep having house prices go up at that rate, you do definitely get into a bubble, and that just has been pierced. We don't have data yet on prices because that always lags, but we know that sales are plummeting. We just got data on housing starts are down about 10% from the prior month. And in terms of mortgage applications, because we get weekly data on that, that's down about 15, 16% for purchase mortgages. So it's had a big impact on the housing market. And I expect that will filter through to rent, hopefully in the not very distant future. Those are different measures, house sure. sale prices and rents, but they tend to go together.
But they tend to go together. And Dean, for most families, it's that how, you know, buying a house is your major asset. And if you can't get in on the ground floor, you know, when things are affordable, you can't get that asset into your finances.
Yeah, we like for people to be able to buy homes. This big jump in interest rates, it's going to make it unaffordable for a lot of people. Again, the flip side is if house prices fall, then they will become more affordable, particularly if interest rates go back down. We did get a little bit spoiled. I mean, we had 30-year mortgage rates under 3%. I don't know when you last had that, not in my lifetime. You'd have to go back many, many decades. I don't expect mortgage interest rates to go back to 3%. In fact, I kind of hope not, because I mean we have a real weak economy. But maybe they'll get back into the fours, which if house prices fall some and you have mortgage interest rates a little over 4%, then we'd probably be in a better world for most people looking to buy a home.
One of our listeners talked about the 1970s, and Allison, that's when Volcker raised interest rates to 20%? Do I have that right? Was it close to that?
Yeah, it was high. It's when people.
I mean, it was double digits, clearly.
Yeah. It was 20%.
How much?
Yeah.
20% at the peak, yeah.
At 20% at the peak. I mean, is there any reason to do that now?
No. I mean, as I said, I think we're all just gunning for 3.5%, and that's on the higher end still. I mean, maybe the more extreme people are saying 5 or 6%, but I don't think anyone thinks we're at that point.
But in hindsight, Allison, was that a smart thing for Volcker to do?
It was. I mean, they'd had, you know, like a decade of sort of like bad inflation on and off. And, you know, he really needed to do something extreme. Inflation was also much, much higher than it was right now. So I think, you know, we got a dividend of that for like 40 years of low inflation, because it really convinced people that the Fed was very serious and had the tools and sort of will to do something about inflation. And that belief, I think, also contributed to the low inflationary environment for years. So we should all be really grateful for it and hope that some of that dividend is still there, and it will definitely not come to that.
Dean, does the Federal Reserve, does it have a reputation problem? Do people still, I mean, I don't know if they ever did entirely believe in the Federal Reserve Bank?
I'm not sure how much thought most people give to the Fed, you know.
Exactly.
I remember during the 90s, Alan Greenspan became sort of a figure of worship. I remember Bob Woodward wrote a book called Maestro, and he had Greenspan like waving his hands like a conductor at a and Greenspan, they would announce he was at a Nationals game and everyone would get up and applaud. I'm fairly confident most people had very little idea what he did, but they gave him credit for the economy doing well. I don't think the Fed really has a reputation problem, in part because mm-hmm. I think most people aren't all that sure of what it does. Jerome Powell, I think, you know, for my part, just my own view, I think he's done a very good job as Fed chair. He's made a commitment to trying to have unemployment as low as possible, which prior chairs really had not done, or at least certainly not said as explicitly as Mr. Powell. I mean, he's recognized that when we get low unemployment, that means that disadvantaged groups, blacks, Hispanics, people with criminal records, they're able to get jobs. And that's a great thing. And that's exactly what he said. So I really appreciate that about Mr. Powell's Fed chair. And, you know, from my view, you know, no one's perfect, but he's done a very good job.
And that's Dean Baker, again, senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Also with us, Allison Schrager, senior fellow with the Manhattan Institute. She's also a columnist at Bloomberg Opinion. We've been talking about the Federal Reserve and the U.S. economy, the high rate of inflation. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Allison, what marks would you give Jerome Powell?
Like a B minus. I mean, I think it was clear much earlier than he let on that inflation wasn't transitory and he was a bit behind the curve raising rates. But I like to think he's redeeming himself now.
So B minus. I mean, I always felt good to get a B minus.
I said this is a B minus pre-grade.
It's not a failing grade.
Inflation.
Right.
No, pre-grade inflation. So got like it. When a B minus was like good, but could be better. not great inflation. B minus.
Dean, what do you make of the media coverage of inflation? As and again, that's kind of a broad-based question, but you know, some of even just the tone of the coverage just seems really over the top.
Yeah, I would certainly say that. I mean, inflation's bad. I mean, I had people tell me, well, people don't need the media to tell them that gas prices are high. And I sort of say that both ways, that yes, that's right. I mean, on the one hand, it's a big deal. People have to pay higher gas prices, but it's only part of the economic picture. And I remember when the jobs report for May came out, it was really a great report. Mm-hmm. We created lots of jobs. Wage growth was slowing, and I'm going to say it's a good thing. I don't typically say that, but it's a good thing because we're concerned, Alice and I, everyone, I think, a wage price spiral. We don't want the 70s back. Wage growth is slowing. You can't have a wage price spiral if wage growth is slowing rather than speeding up. So it was a great report, and I happened to be watching CNN. They mentioned for a minute, oh, we created so many jobs, and then they jumped. But inflation, and you know, inflation's important and everything, but the fact we have 3.6% unemployment, the fact that we've recovered the vast majority of the jobs we lost in the downturn, the fact that people are able to quit their jobs that they don't like, these are really, really big things. But we hear almost exclusively about inflation, and that I think is unfortunate.
Well, Allison, you write a column at Bloomberg Opinion. Thinking of your colleagues, and I think we're talking more about TV coverage, but nonetheless, I'd be curious about your reaction.
I'm a retirement economist, so I've always been obsessed with inflation, even when probably there was no reason to be, just because, you know, it does impact people on fixed incomes so harshly. So, I mean, I think, you know, unlike unemployment, inflation impacts everyone. As I said, it makes everyone poorer. It makes everything more uncertain. And I think even inflation, anything even above 5% can be, you know, quite damaging, particularly if it's unexpected and not predictable. So I don't think it's been overblown. I think it actually really is a very serious problem. And, you know, the longer it goes on, we do risk sort of igniting that wage price spiral. So we do need to take it very seriously.
Well, I appreciate both of you joining us today in Radio Times. I learned a lot speaking to both of you. Allison Schrager, thanks so much.
Anytime. Thank you.
You're welcome. She's a senior fellow with the Manhattan Institute, as I mentioned, a columnist at Bloomberg Opinion. Dean Baker, thank you very much as well.
Thanks a lot for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
Me too. And he's a senior economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. To replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.